To badquicker.com podcast. Today is March 29th, 2012. Actually, it's March 28th, but this will be broadcast on March 29th. Oh, and I'm Ben Stone. Glad to meet you. We have a lot of new listeners, so some of this is going to be some new information for some of the people. It's going to be old information for some people. When I'm able to record either late at night or early in the morning, the podcasts have a tendency to be, more focused. Sometimes I wander a bit no matter what. Anyway, I'm wandering right now. So I do want to welcome the new listeners. We have had a fairly dramatic increase in the number of listeners in the last, 3 or 4 weeks, and specifically in the last week. So welcome aboard, all the new listeners. We are on the Liberty Radio Network, and we're on iTunes, and we're at badquicker.com. And if you want to connect with any of us on Facebook, just go to Facebook. Or you can go to badquicker.com and hit the Facebook button. It'll take you right to the correct page. That way you don't have to worry about bumping into somebody who sells cookies or butter. And oftentimes my co-host is my daughter Kai, and to my knowledge we are the only father-daughter anarchist slash liberty-oriented podcast on the internet slash radio. Now, if you've been following along the last couple of days, I've been sort of taking pot shots at these Thrive people, this Thrive movement and Thrive movie. And I don't want to carry this really into a big deal on the third podcast in a row on these people. This is why I didn't want to really take on the zeitgeist people, because, you know, it's like stirring bees in a hive or something. You just start swatting one after the other, and there's just more and more and more, and it never ends. But I did want to say one thing. I was very disappointed. One of our listeners here. Actually, I started introducing the staff, and I only got to myself and Kai, so we do have others as well. But anyway, one of our listeners mentioned that the folks over at Anarchast had interviewed the people from Thrive. So I popped over to YouTube and looked it up on Anarchast. And holy cow, I thought I was disappointed in the Daily Bell's interview. I thought the Daily Bell threw softball questions, and you know, I'm really disappointed in Anarchast. I think I mentioned on Facebook that it was a fluff interview, and you know, I mean, it's great. I have done interviews where I'm interviewing somebody that I don't agree with, but I respect them and I bring them on. I let them say their thing. And then, you know, I go on about my business, and I podcast what it is that I believe and what I think and everything. But if I brought a guest on who told me, who was a multimillionaire, by the way, and told me that he had a magic energy producing machine, that he had seen it operate, he knew it existed, but that secret bad guys are keeping it from being released to the public. And as soon as he can get it released, all the world's problems are going to end. If somebody came on my podcast and told me that, I think I might have a question or two for them. I think I wouldn't just go, really? That's wonderful. Now tell me about my eyes. Anyway, so I was very disappointed with the Anarchast. But the Anarchast interview with those guys, it was just totally fluff. And like I said, you know, they just spend the entire time name dropping and they don't really say anything of any substance. But, okay, so hopefully I'm done with Thrive. I don't want to think about Thrive anymore. I don't want to. And of course, now I'm back to talking about Thrive again. On Anarchast, he didn't, and this is the people from the Dollar Vigilante, so they should know something about Austrian economics. And knowing something about Austrian economics and running a site called the Dollar Vigilante, you would think that they would at least click over to Thrive's website and look under the heading of economics and see that they entirely promote socialist economics, that there's nothing but Keynesian and Chicago economists on their site, a bunch of greenbackers, and there are no actual Austrian economists involved in this movement. I'm sure if they'd call up Tom Woods, if he, you know, or any of the others of actual Austrian economists, would be more than happy to talk to him. They talk to me. I'm not a multi-millionaire, and I can get a hold of these people and talk to them. You know, I'm sure that if the people from Thrive actually made an effort to get a hold of the people at the Mises Institute, the people at the Mises Institute would be more than happy to talk to them. But then again, if all they're going to get is a bunch of greenbackers and Keynesians on their site, maybe the Mises people are smart enough to not want anything to do with them. And maybe the Dollar Vigilante and maybe the Daily Bell and maybe Anarchast should have looked at Thrive's website as well. So now I'm going to say this again. Hopefully I'm done with Thrive. I don't have to think about Thrive anymore. I don't have to talk about them. Nobody will bring them back up and they can just fade away and make all their further millions or whatever it is that they're, whatever their scheme, whatever they're up to, they can go do that and not bother, at least not bother me. Then again, I said that about the greenbackers, and it seems like every couple of weeks somebody throws me a, what about this, and throws me another greenbacker thing, and I have to go and debunk that. So, I don't know. Just, it really is. It's like unraveling. I was going to compare it to bees in a hive again, but I think it's more like trying to unravel a spider web. When you get into the levels of deception and the depths of a con artist like this, I think it's like trying to unwrap a spider web, because it constantly sticks to your fingers. You can't get it off of you, and yet, you know, you can't stop at the same time. And it's like, have you ever walked into a spider web unexpectedly? And for the next half an hour, you're picking imaginary pieces out of your hair. Pretty much any real well thought out con is like that. And well, since I'm on the topic of con artists, and this is not just the Thrive, this is all con artists. I've talked quite a bit about con artists before. It's really important to be able to spot them and know what it is that they're trying to do and figure them out ahead of time. Even if you don't know every aspect of their con, it's good to know the basic techniques of a con artist so that you know when they approach you. And one of the things that you'll always see with a con artist is his con will always depend on two things. One, the good nature of the mark being the victim, the good nature of the mark, and the greed of the mark. That's the two things that the con artist has to have. He watches, he looks for people who have a general good nature and want to help people, and a tiny little sliver of greed stuck somewhere back in their personality. This desire to have something for nothing, or to have something for far less than what its actual value is. And so I've used the example before of the violin con, real quick. I won't do a whole thing on it, but the violin con is where the first person in the con leaves a violin or a violin case. Typically, it's if it is an actual violin, it's a real cheap, something from something you might pick up at a pawn shop or whatever, a real cheap violin stuck in a case, and they'll leave it right outside of a busy shop or a busy, let's say, a busy restaurant or a busy bar, and then a member of the con will bring, actually they don't leave it there, but the member of the con brings the violin in its case in to the shopkeeper. He needs to talk to the manager on duty or the actual shop owner. The shop owner is better because he has a better ability to follow through on the con. And the first con artist will say to the shopkeeper, look, I just found this violin. And it could be anything. It'd be a watch. It could be car keys. It could be anything. I just found this violin out in front of your door, and it doesn't have a name on it, but it looks really expensive. You might want to hang on to it. I'm sure the owner is going to come back for it. Well, the guy is literally standing there with the violin case in his hand, handing it to the owner. Your second person in the con calls the shop or the bar or the restaurant or whatever and asks for the owner. At that point, the person on the phone says, I just left my super expensive violin. It's worth thousands and thousands of dollars. I just left it there right outside your door. Is there any possible way you could look and see if it's there? Of course, the shopkeeper, wanting to be the nice guy and do the right thing, he says, as it just so happens, we have it right here. So the guy on the phone says, hang on to it. I'll be right over. I'll give you a $200 reward if you just hold on to it. I'll be right over. It's going to take me about 2 hours to get there. And so the shopkeeper tells the guy who brought the violin in, what do you know? The guy on the phone is the owner of the violin. He's going to be over in about 2 hours. He's going to give you a $200 reward. And the guy who walked in with the violin is like, yeah, you know, wow, I've got a bus to catch in like 3 minutes and I'm going to be out of town and I won't be back for another 6 months. How about this? How about I split the reward with you? You give me $100 now, I give you the violin, and when the guy gets here and gives you the $200 reward, you can have half of it. And the shopkeeper, this is playing on that little strain of greed in the shopkeeper's mind. He sees how he can get $100 for free. And he can help out two people at the same time. So he's both being a nice guy, and there's that little sliver of greed. So he takes the violin, he pulls $100 out of his till, hands it to the con artist. The con artist disappears. The violin maybe cost him 10 bucks or something. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't matter what the violin is. The violin can be a watch, it can be car keys, it can be, an important, it can be anything. The object is not what's important. The con is everything. And so that's how the violin con works. It works on the greed and the desire to do good. And when these two things collide in a person's mind, they stop thinking clearly, and the con depends on that. So when we hear something like this Thrive thing, where they're offering, first off, they're doing all this name dropping. We're one of you. We're one of you. We're one of you. Larkin Rose, Stefan Molyneux, Mises, Rothbard, Ron Paul, dropping names just on an epidemic proportions of name dropping. And then they dangle this thing out for you. Look, free energy, free energy. Yeah, I realize no one has ever been able to do that, and it's physically impossible. But hey, don't think, it's free energy. And the person seeing these things just stumbles right in and goes, oh boy, this is going to be good. If you really think Thrive is great, if you really think Thrive is something that, if you think they're one of us, if you think they're libertarians or if you think they're anarchists, go to Thrive's website, go across the top of the website, pick down the 12 items or whatever they're called, go to economics, and take a look at the people quoted. You have Bill Stills, the socialist greenbacker, not an Austrian economist. You have other economists on there who are Keynesian economists, Bush appointees, green, huggy-feely, save the environment by taxing the world with carbon credits. These are the people that are the economists that are behind this. Those are not Austrian economics. That's not Austrian economics. Now, again, let me go back to Rothbard. you know, Rothbard's, and this is a horror, I should just get the real quote. I've been saying this thing so often for the last few days, I should actually go get the real quote. But this is a horrible twisting of the quote, but the intention is the same. Rothbard said, you don't have to be a great economist to be a libertarian. But if you're going to talk about economics, you need to know what you're talking about. And that's the case with this Thrive thing. They throw a whole section of their website devoted to economics, and they throw all these so-called economists out there. And even though when they're in an interview, they talk about Mises and Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe, and they talk about all these other Austrian economists, but on their website, it's all socialists. It's all Keynesians and Chicago economists. That's not libertarian. Okay, so hopefully we're done with that. 16 minutes into the rant, let me hit something different. And now for something completely different. Oh, that does remind me. One more thing. One more thing. I'm sorry, folks. One more thing that it reminded me of, and I actually did some a light amount of searching on the internet, and I couldn't find the video I was looking for, and I gave up. But there's an old Monty Python skit from back in the Monty Python's Flying Circus days, and I think it was late on maybe 73 or 74 in the years. And the gist of the skit, they have, it kind of shows like a TV set, like an English BBC TV set, and they have all the whole cast of Monty Python, plus the female actors that they hardly ever acknowledge. All of the whole Monty Python crew is on camera, and they're all dressed like college age kids, and they've all got exaggerated happy faces all over themselves. And they're tackling the hard-hitting issues of the day, like the energy crisis, or like war and peace and things like this. And all their solutions are unbelievably simplistic, like something you would have eight-year-olds tell you, like, all we have to do to stop the war is if everybody gets along. There we go. That's all it takes. And there's this kind of simplistic, and that's the gist of the skit, is to mock these TV, these cheap TV productions where they come on with a complex issue and they just toss something out and say, there it is, and that's the solution. There you go. One of the things that kind of bothers me about these do-it-yourself TV shows and do-it-yourself networks and so forth on the cable TV, there's a series of these do-it-yourself commercials that are sponsored by one company or another, and they come on in this 30 or 60 second commercial, and they're like, this is how you make your bathroom look like it's been redone. All you got to do is just sand down your sink, spray paint it, and you're done. No, that looks like you spray painted your sink. That doesn't look like a professional redo. And that's the kind of silly things that these DIY stuff very often present to you. It's like, okay, well, all we're going to do is staple this to the wall, and we'll hang one of these over here and one of these, and now your house is going to sell. Really? Come on. And then they walk the people through the house, and the people, first the same people walk through the house before their little redo, and the people are like, I don't like this paint, ew, this is ugly. And then they come back after the redo, and they're like, oh, this is wonderful. Yeah, but they know they're on camera. They know they're being broadcast on a TV show. They know that they were brought in ahead of time. They know they're seeing the after. Of course you're going to get that reaction out of them, because people love to be photographed, and they like to play along to these things. And, you know, it's these simplistic things. Like, okay, so Thrive. So, oh yeah, our problems are going to be solved. All we have to do is just have election reform, and we'll just shrink the government, and we'll cut back on the military, and we'll have a perpetual energy machine, and everything will be good. Well, there we go. Aren't we all happy now? We're just all living in libertarian utopia, aren't we? Folks, don't fall for this stuff. Recognize these people for what they are. And again, I don't know if they're just con artists or if it's a form of, some kind of a new form of limousine liberal guilt that's now taken on the limousine libertarian guilt, maybe. Maybe. Is that what it is? I don't know, but it's simplistic and it's sickening. And I hate, just hate, and I reserve that word. I hardly ever use the word hate because it's a very harsh word. But I hate the fact that good people, solid people, are being conned by these shysters. Okay, so now I'm at 20 minutes talking about this same stupid thing that I didn't want to talk about. I didn't want to talk about 3 days ago. Okay, so something I did want to talk about. I have a real good friend on the internet that I've known a long time, and he's a good guy. I mean, he and I are not going to see eye to eye on everything politically, but above and beyond that, he's a really good guy. He is a real, what you would call a stand-up guy. He's the kind of a guy that if you were in a mess, you would want to call him for help because he would drop everything and come and help you. And so he's a big Ron Paul supporter, and I appreciate that. You know, if you're a longtime listener, you know that I like Ron Paul. I appreciate Ron Paul. I voted for Ron Paul in 1988 and in 2008, but I also believe that Ron Paul has absolutely no chance of getting elected because the Republicans are simply not going to let that happen. They'll cheat, they'll lie, they'll do anything up to it, including an assassination, to keep Ron Paul out of out of victory lane, so to speak. But above and beyond, I don't want to turn this into a Ron Paul rant again. So my friend is a Ron Paul supporter, and I appreciate that, and I'm glad that he's enthusiastic about something like that. But I put up a thing in Facebook that said something to the effect of, if voting mattered, they wouldn't let you do it, or they would make it illegal, or I can't remember the exact words, but there's variations of these pictures. If voting mattered, they wouldn't let you do it. And he came back and said, well, if voting doesn't matter, because it is becoming more and more apparent that the votes are rigged, that state by state by state the primaries have been rigged, that that it's entirely fake, and that whole counties full of votes have just disappeared, and it's all a hoax. It's all just terrible hokery. And as this begins to dawn on more and more libertarians that are supporting Ron Paul's run, more and more people are asking the question, well, what do we do? If the one thing that we've put all of our hopes in is fake, the election, which it is, folks, if the election's fake, then what do we do? What can we do? Hey, don't do anything. Look, here's the deal. The elections are fake. The state, that's only half the story. The elections are fake, but that's only half the story. The truth is, the elections are a function of the state. If you believe in the state, if you believe in your mind that one group of people can get together and make decisions, and based on the decisions of those people, then they can use aggression on other people, if you believe that's right, then hey, get involved, vote, do all that stuff. But if you believe that it's wrong for one group of people to designate officers or designate however you want to name these people who will now come and use aggression on you, take your property, take your money, take your property, take your life, take, draft you, put you into any kind of servitude that they feel like, if you think that's good, then have fun with that state. But if you think that's bad, then why would you want to get involved with that and try to make your vote be the one that throws the group over the majority so that you can lord on some other group? If you believe it's bad for people to use the state to aggress on you, then why would you think it's good for you to use the state to lord over somebody else? Why would you think that? But now here's the problem. The very pragmatic person hearing this argument their mind will fall immediately back to the same thing. Well, what do we do? What do we do? Because you're only seeing the state. You're only seeing your belief, your faith in the state. Let's cover this one more time. The difference between the state and the government, okay? This is something that I think a lot of libertarians and a lot of anarcho-capitalists are missing. The difference between the state and the government. The government is the people who act on behalf of what their beliefs are. The government is bureaucrats, people who, at the DMV office or BMV, according to which state you're in. The government is the police officer who thinks that he's doing his duty. It's the congressman who thinks he's doing his duty. All those people are the government. But the state is the myth in your mind. The state is the mystical belief that those people in government are doing what they're doing rightfully. When you believe that those people in government are rightfully using aggression upon people who have never aggressed, if you believe that's right, then you believe in the state. But if you don't believe that it's right, if you don't believe that the people in government have the right to aggress on people, then you need to realize that that whole myth of the state is just a religious belief. It's a fanatical religious belief. And when you reject that fanatical religious belief, you have to be consistent with it and realize that it goes two ways. You can't say the state is evil or the government is evil when it aggresses on me, but it's okay if I use it to aggress on somebody else. You're still believing in the state. You're authorizing the state to act in that way. So you have to realize that this is a mythology. The belief in the state is a mythology. And when you get that out of your mind, then you can begin to deal with those who work for government and on an individual basis and realize that they are simply individuals who believe a radical religion, the state, and they act on those beliefs. And now you can deal with individuals. I've often said that when you're in this position where it seems like you're just being swallowed up by the state, it's very much like quicksand. You like in the movies, because real quicksand is different. But in the movies, you see the movie quicksand, or quicksand in the movies. The person gets stuck in quicksand, and if they hold still and do not struggle, they will slowly sink. But if they struggle, they will sink really fast. And so typically in the movies, the person panics and starts fighting the quicksand, and they sink really fast and die. But if they can keep their mind together and don't fight the quicksand, just hold still and call for help, then the good guy comes and pulls them out. See, that's the way the movies work. But in thinking of the state, when you're captured into the system of the state and you're thinking, oh no, we have to get Ron Paul elected. Oh no, we have to get Gary Johnson elected. Oh no, we have to get this. Oh no, we have to get term limits. That's what we have to do. That'll solve everything. If we just get term limits, oh, if we have campaign reform, you're struggling. You're in the quicksand and you're struggling. And so what do you do? Do you just do nothing? Do you do nothing? No. You stop believing in the quicksand. Because the quicksand is the myth. Stop believing in it. That's the very beginning of freedom, when you can realize that the matrix is fake and you can open your eyes and step away from it. But as long as you're in it, thinking you can manipulate it and use it to your goals, you're part of it. You're part of the problem. Okay, I'm going to break for our commercial. And I'll be right back. Hang with me through the commercial. It's only 2 minutes, so I'll be right back. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from badquaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sitting through the commercial. I appreciate that. I'm glad you're still with me. And I did want to mention once again that we're on the Liberty Radio Network. And I forgot to mention, too, last night, Michael W. Dean from the Freedom Fiends called me. And in the middle of the night, we did a little podcast. If I can remember to do it, I'll put a link on the page on badquaker.com where this podcast appears to the link over where Michael W. Dean put the podcast that we did in the middle of the night. Does that make sense? Did I say that in a way that makes sense? Just go to badquaker.com and look on the page where this podcast is located. And I'm assuming I'll remember to do this, to put a link to Michael W. Dean's podcast that he recorded of us chatting in the middle of the night. Okay, so I'm working on an article, and I haven't done an article in a while. The website is now about a year old. Originally, my wife and some other people set the website up for the purpose of giving me a place to publish my articles that I was writing. And so I started out doing that. That was a year ago. I think I said that. That was a year ago that I started publishing articles on badquaker.com. And then it took a little while, and eventually we started getting the equipment, and I started reading the articles and getting more and more hits to the website. And then Kai joined me, and we started doing actual podcasts. But in the last few months, I haven't had time to actually sit down and write an article. You know, there are people, I'm thinking of Gary North specifically. Gary North is like, he's like the Hercules of the, he's not like the Hercules. He's like an unbelievable workhorse of the libertarian movement. He writes every day and writes large quantities every single day. And he's published like over 50 books. Plus, he has a huge website with membership, and he publishes in there constantly, and he publishes on lewrockwell.com, and the guy just, he writes a ton every day. And then you look at somebody, that's Gary North, you look at somebody like me, and for me to publish one single article, for me to publish an article of like 1,800 words, I probably put somewhere in the range of 25 or 30 hours into it because my brain just is, you know, slow, and I struggle with making sure that everything is just, you know, meticulously covered and everything, and I go back and redo it. So whenever I do an article, it's really a high energy thing, And of late, because of the schedule that we've been hitting for the last few months, I haven't got to write a single article. But I've been working on one now for a little at a time for a couple of weeks, and it's called What is the State? So I wanted to go over some of the notes and sort of a rough outline of it and give you an idea of it. Eventually, I'll probably do a proper article, and then I'll read the article, and we might put it on YouTube, like we put one up there on YouTube with pictures that kind of match the flow of the article. If you want to look on YouTube, well, the best thing to do, let's see. Well, you can search on YouTube for badquaker.com, and that might get you to it. Or the name of the article itself is called Anarchy and the World of Tomorrow. So, and so maybe if I can get this article done and maybe do the same with it, we might have a second one on YouTube. That would be cool. So, what is the state? What are the characteristics of the state? How does the state behave? What other entities are like the state? And knowing what we know, what can we safely assume about the state? Now, with an animal, we would ask things like, what kind of skin or covering does it have? For instance, is it exoskeletal? Does it have a soft skin? You know, what is it, scaly skin? Does it have hair? All these things we would ask if we're trying to figure out what kind of an animal that we're dealing with. What kind of a body does it have? Is it a segmented body? Is it a vertebra? Is it, is it exoskeletal? What type of a body does it have? What does it consume? What does the state consume? Again, if we're going to analyze anything that we find, we would be asking these questions or similar questions about whatever it is that we're talking about. And finally, how does it reproduce? When we start to look at something that we're that we really want to inspect, this is the kind of questions that we want to ask about it. So, the state is not like an animal. No matter how much we look at the animal kingdom, we can't find anything in the animal kingdom that correlates in any kind of description with the state. The state has no skin. It has no covering of any kind. It has no body. It technically doesn't consume anything, and really, although in a sense it reproduces, in another sense it consumes everything it reproduces. So the state doesn't really reproduce, it doesn't really consume, because again, the state is a way of thinking. It's not really an animal or a person or a thing that you can go and put your hands on and say, look, here it is, here's the state. Hold it up and see if light goes through it. You can't do that with the state. So the state is not like an animal. There are two things that I've thought of that the state closely resembles. The state closely resembles an ant colony, not the individual ants. It's nothing like the individual ants. But the state is similar to an ant colony, and I'll get into that in just a minute. The other thing the state is like is the state is like an illness. Now, as I thought about the state as an illness, I thought about it in two different ways. A, the state is like a mental disorder, and I'll go into that and break it down a little bit further in a minute. And B, the state is like a viral infection. Now, Kai and I stole this part of the description from Kai because she was the first one that brought this up to me. And Kai and I have talked about this on podcasts on several occasions, that the state has characteristics that are very much like a viral infection. A viral infection can't exist on its own. It has to have a host. And what does it do when it infects the host? It goes in and it steals from the host genetic material so that it can replicate itself. It does not have the capability of replicating itself unless it steals some of the genetic material from the host. So it goes in and infects a cell, and it causes that cell
to reproduce in a way that makes another, instead of making another cell like itself, it makes a cell that is very similar to that original virus. And then it starts replicating that over and over and over and over again. And that's how it invades the body. And that's why a virus is so hard for a body to fight off, because when the body first sees the virus starting to reproduce, the body mistakenly says, oh, that's part of me, because a very large part of the virus is actually stolen material from the body itself. So the animal that's infected with the virus has a much harder time fighting the virus than, say, it does a bacterial infection, where it can just send out antibodies and it's really easy for the animal to recognize the infection. Okay, so in that sense, the state is very much like a virus. It cannot do anything on its own. It requires a host, and it requires the host to provide the material for it to do the things that it needs to do. It can't do anything on its own. Now, let's go back and talk about the ant colony comparison. That which drives the state is similar to that which drives an ant colony. The ants act as if instructed, yet there is no instructor. Although governments have centralized leadership, the state does not. Now think about that for a minute. All governments have centralized leadership, but the state itself, the larger entity, that thing that's worldwide, and I'm not talking about the UN, I'm not talking about any governing body. Any governing body you can name is a government. But the state is that mythical being that is beyond any individual government. It's the concept that this government is legitimate. It's the belief that the government is legitimate. It's the belief that any government could be a legitimate thing. That's the state. That's the larger entity. And really, there's only one of them, and it's worldwide, and it's infected almost everybody. That's really what the state is. It's not any individual government. So then, the state is not like an ant colony in the sense that the state learns and it seems self-aware, whereas the ant colony only adapts to environmental stimulus and follows behavior best suited to maintain the health of the colony. So let's think about an ant colony for a minute. There's a queen in an ant colony, but actually the queen is only there to produce eggs. And that's all she does. She doesn't actually direct traffic, so to speak. She doesn't tell the soldier ants to go out and do this, or the gathering ants to go out and do that, or the hunting ants to go out. She doesn't tell any individual ant what to do. All the ants essentially know their job, and they just go out. And any individual ant is not aware of the wholeness of the ant colony. All he knows is, hey, I go out, I look for seeds, I find seeds, I drop scent markers, and I come back with the seed, and I tell everybody where it's at, and then we go back out and go get as many seeds as we can. That's all I know. That's all I do. I just do my job. And then another ant is like, I just protect the hive. The colony. I stand here on the top of the anthill. Sometimes I walk back and forth, and if anything gets near it, I sound an alarm, and I attack whatever it is that's trying to get into our anthill. And another ant is like, well, I don't know whatever everybody else is doing, but all I do is I carry fungus from down in the deep part of the anthill, and I bring it up to where the larvae are, and I feed the larvae, and that's all I know. That's all I do. And then another ant is like, I don't know what everybody else does, but I go to the queen, I pick up an egg, I bring it over, I put it in the nursery, and then I make sure and put it in there correctly, and then I go back and I get another egg. That's all I do. I don't know of anybody else. I don't know that any. I don't even know that that there's an existing world above, outside of these two chambers that I spend my whole life in. I just go back and forth between the queen and the nursery, and I just move eggs back and forth. That's what I do. And there's no awareness in that ant that there is a world outside of those two chambers and the path that goes between them. And so this ant colony functions, and it does all the things that it does without a central intelligence telling it how to function, what to do. And yet, this anthill can move from place to place. As it exhausts all of the food in one particular area, it will uproot itself completely and seek a new area. Or, as the ant if the ant colony is thriving and it's overpopulating its area, it will naturally divide itself and put out a new queen and put out a new set of ants to go with that queen, and they'll move away from the original colony. And all these things are done without any central control of any kind and without any intelligence understanding the greater purposes or the greater movements of the colony itself. But the state is different. The state is like that in many ways. The cop is just doing his thing. He may be aware that there are congressmen. He may be aware that there are presidents and mayors and councilmen. He may be aware of all these things, but he's just doing his little part. The cop on the street. He may be a good cop. He's not having anything to do with another cop who is a corrupt cop. He's not that guy. He's this guy. So he's just doing his job. He's just doing his thing. He's not out invading some foreign country. He's on his beat doing his job. And then somebody else that's invading a foreign country, he doesn't think about the politics. He doesn't go in and analyze, is this a good policy? Is this a bad policy? No, he doesn't think of those things. He has a job to do, and so he goes and does his job. And the CIA guy who's just sitting there flying a drone, and he gets coordinates to a certain location, and he puts that into this computer, and he flies the drone to a location, and he pushes the button, and the location explodes. And he doesn't go through and analyze every aspect of this and say, am I doing something moral? Am I doing something immoral? Am I killing children? Am I destroying a wedding party? Or is this a collection of the worst terrorists in the world that I'm bombing? He doesn't go, he can't. He can't let himself go through all those steps, because if he did, he wouldn't be able to do his job. He would have to go through all the information that everybody else in his whole network understands, and everybody else who made the decision to tell him to push the button. He would have to analyze that, and he can't do all that. That would be impossible. So, as a matter of faith, he believes that all of those other people are doing their job just like he's doing his job, and the wedding party blows up. And that's how the state works. But the state, now all of this, everything I just described fits with the ant colony. But the state has something else. The state has a certain ability to remember things and to learn from things. And as you examine history, and I plan to do this in the article, I don't have the time today, I'm running out of time, and I need to get to other part of the article, but when I get to actually do the article itself, I'll break this down and present more evidence on this. But the state has adapted over the centuries, and it's actually learned, and it's figured things out, and it's made horrible mistakes, and it's fixed those mistakes, and it's adapted itself. And there seems to be a larger conscious driving the state, and I believe there is a conscious driving the state. And I'll get to that when I do the article. Now, let me get back to the article, now that I've teased that. The state, the myth of the state, infects the mind of humans like a psychological disorder. It seems to be an anxiety-based belief and contains characteristics similar to the generalized anxiety disorder, with unsubstantiated fear-driven tendencies similar to a phobic disorder. How often do you see someone who is terrified at the thought of anarchy because they're convinced that all of their neighbors would just fall upon them and devour them? They're convinced that the only thing that keeps society held together is that there's a cop on every street corner. And yet, there's really not that many cops. If society really were so evil that we would all just fall on each other, we would do that now because the cops wouldn't have a chance. That's the reason why in a place where there's heavy riots like going on over in Europe right now and things like that, the cops have to come out early and make a really hard stand, because if the population in general ever really realizes the strength they have, they'll overrun the cops in a matter of moments. So, but there's this anxiety disorder that infects statists' mind, and they think, oh, if it weren't for the state, my all my neighbors would come and steal everything I have. Yeah, but you wouldn't do that, would you? Would you go and steal your neighbor's stuff? Well, then why do you think they would come and steal yours? It's an illogical, unsustained fear. It's a phobic disorder. Now, the myth of the state also includes a type of mood disorder, similar to bipolar disorder, causing people to oscillate between feelings of defeat and despair and helplessness to almost uncontrolled excitement. The two faces of victims of the state are defeat and obedience, and euphoria and revolution. Now think about this. This is the bipolar aspect of statism. You are always either in a state of being either complete obedience with your head down, your head bowed, just going to work, just trying to make it through this, just want to, don't cause any trouble, just get through, let's just get through this, you know, try to make it to retirement someday, I'll be happy on the beach and everything will be fine. But right now, I just got to get to work, I can't think about these things, I just got to go and I got to do this. And that is a level of obedience that you don't want to see what's really going on. And bordering with that is this level of defeat. Like, yeah, I know things are bad, but what am I going to do about it? If I kick against the system, they'll beat me down again. And so, so you have that level of helplessness. And the other side of that is this uncontrolled excitement. The euphoria that we saw in 2008, where people were so excited about Obama that they just acted crazy happy. He would come walking on the stage, and you can actually, I'll pick on the Ron Paul people a little bit. You can kind of see that with Ron Paul fans. You can kind of see the level of euphoria that they think that they might be able to turn the state to their side. And this level of illogical euphoria that where they're so excited that they just can't contain themselves. And the flip side of that same aspect is revolution. Now, when revolution finally starts, now we're not talking about a few protesters in the streets, but real revolution. When real actual revolution starts, people take on a whole new nature. They act in ways that they would never normally act. If you think about, if you have any knowledge of history whatsoever, and you think about things like the behavior of people during the French Revolution, or the behavior of people during the Russian Revolution, or the behavior of certain areas of Eastern Europe when the Soviet Union collapsed, and there was localized dramatic violence, and you think about how revolutions sweep across North Africa in the last couple of years, and how the people are just whipped into a frenzy during these time frames. Not only the crowds of people themselves, but the police or the military go into feeding frenzies at times like this. And this is very much exactly, actually, like bipolar disorder. This flopping between this defeat and obedience, and then going to euphoria and or revolution. Euphoria and revolution being on the same, you know, two manifestations of the same side of this hyper end of the disorder. Now let's continue here. Individuals infected by the state may also show signs of paranoid schizophrenia, including delusions of grandeur, delusions of persecution, or both. They may become constantly afraid because they're convinced that others are plotting against them. They may seek retaliation against imagined enemies, or they may imagine themselves as a kind of a superhuman, better than other humans, associated with a different locality or possessing a slightly different appearance, skin tone, clothing, or having a different status in society. So in looking at this as a mental illness through as the type of schizophrenia, these delusions of persecution and delusions of grandeur, isn't that nationalism, where we are terrified that poor countries on the other side of the world that can barely put a bowl of rice into the hands of each worker each day, and we're paranoid that that tiny little weak country is going to somehow attack a big, strong, powerful country like ours. North Korea is not a threat, folks. Or we're so afraid that a country like Iran is going to attack us, and yet we have it surrounded literally on every side by something like 500,000 soldiers, and Iran has never attacked anybody else in centuries, and yet we are so paranoid that Iran is out to get us that we're ready to go to war with them. Is that not delusions of grandeur and delusions of persecution at the same time? And what is it about any nationality that causes the people in that country to think that somehow they are better than the people in another country? So much so that they're willing to go to war and have the young men from their country kill the young men from the other country simply because they're from another country, simply because their leaders have made them afraid of those people under usually lies, but certainly under illogical levels of paranoia. And very often, people within one nationality will look at themselves as a kind of superhumans, whether we're talking about Nazis who thought they were some type of super race, or whether we're talking about Americans who think, who believe in American, the idea that America is somehow special and has to spread their version of democracy around the world, and America has to be the police of the world, and America has to go and settle all the disputes between every little country everywhere in the world, and we have to go and do all these things. Why? Because you believe we're better than they are? Somehow it's okay for us to behave this way. Somehow it's okay for us to go and invade all these different countries. But if China tried to invade us, or if China tried to, you know, put troops on the Mexican border, U.S. would freak out about that. But we can put troops on other countries' borders, and it's okay. You see, that's a superhuman delusion. That's giving yourself, putting yourself into a situation where you look at yourself different than other people. Now, let's go back for a moment. Back to thinking of the state as a virus. Belief in the state spreads by invasion and by direct contact. The state is not self-contained. It depends entirely on its host. The state doesn't always grow uncontrollably. Sometimes it stays relatively stable for long periods of time. But such a manifestation of the state is always susceptible to assimilation by a growing state. So we always want to think of somebody like Liechtenstein or Monaco or perhaps Switzerland. And we think, no, look, there's the state. They're not aggressive. They're not aggressing on anyone else. Well, yeah, but you can have carriers of an illness when the illness doesn't necessarily manifest itself on others. But at some point in time, and some people will argue about this with me, but time will tell, and I believe time will prove me right on this. Eventually, Liechtenstein and Monaco and even Switzerland will all fall to a bigger, more powerful version of the state. Their small localities of their kind governments will at some point be assimilated into the greater that greater beast that is the state. The growing state is identified by its tendency towards war and war preparation, and its host is most vulnerable to the overall myth when active war is engaged. Therefore, war is the condition the state always desires. As continuing war is engaged, the above-noted anxiety, phobic, and mood disorders reach their peak and at times give the illusion of threatening the state itself. However, the state has adapted to this flaw and plays the human tendency towards revolution by offering the existing government as a sacrificial lamb while preserving the myth of the state. Everything is blamed on the old government and its cronies, and a new government, still state-based, simply replaces the old. So the state has learned that this flaw in the state exists, and so the state offers a temporary government as a sacrifice. And when you take the bait and you have a revolution, and the new government takes over, and in comes the new boss, and it's the same as the old boss. Folks, thanks for listening to BadQuaker.com. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to BadQuaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks.